The Senate Judiciary Committee will come to order. We have a continuation of Senator Berglund's bill, Senate File 1179, from the other day. Senator Berglund, welcome back to the committee.
Thank you.
We're sorry that we there was so much going on, we couldn't finish it the other day. But we're glad to have you back.
I really appreciate your flexibility.
Members, we took testimony. We had Senate counsel go over the mechanics of the bill, and then we took testimony from Senator Berglund's witnesses. Senator Berglund, why don't we have you make some couple of comments just to refresh our memory, and then
sure.
We'll have a discussion on your bill.
The bill's been brought to me by folks in my community, which you were gracious enough to listen to, and you know, their concern is the safety and exposure by children to inappropriate things when they are waiting for the school buses in the school bus zones. And so they wanted this law that would create more severe penalties when people are either engaging in prostitution or drug dealing to apply to these school zones. And there are a few amendments that maybe we could look at next, and then I'd be happy to take questions. One of the amendments that has been called to my attention is that would be the A4 amendment.
Let us pass that out.
And I guess as long as I had the bill here, people thought maybe we should look at the whole law. And one of the things about the law is that right now the law refers to rules in parts of it, and in other parts of it, it doesn't. And so this amendment, while it doesn't deal with the original intent of my bill, would simply make it clear that that part of the law that already applies to child care centers would have a reference in the law rather than just a reference in rule.
Madam Chair.
Senator Higgins.
Madam Chair, so Senator Berglund, this is just dealing with child care centers, not in-home child care, folks?
Maybe Senate Counsel can help answer that question. Obviously, this wasn't the original purpose of my bill. As far as I know, child care centers, homes are already taken care of, but in the law today, there's a reference to rules that cover child care centers, and it's not such a good idea to have laws like that because we don't ever know what's happening with the rules.
Yeah. Madam Chair, Senator Berglund, I understood that piece. I was just wondering whether in your drug and prostitution-free zones you were trying to include the areas around individual homes that are child care centers by day or by night.
Madam Chair,
Senator Berglund.
And Senator Higgins, no. The concern that was brought to me had to do with school bus zones.
Okay.
Children are waiting for to go to school to catch a school bus.
Okay, thank you. I'll move the amendment, Madam Chair. Do we have a quorum?
We have quorum.
Okay.
Let the record reflect that we now have a quorum. Senator Berglund, this is the first time your bill is getting a hearing, right?
Yes.
This is the first committee? Okay. All right. Well, Senator Higgins moves the A4 amendment. Does everybody understand what it does? It technically is an author's amendment, but we'll have...
Madam Chair, I'm still not clear. What is a child care center, then, under Chapter 245A? It's not in-home. What is it?
Mr. Backus?
Madam Chair and members, let me just talk very briefly about the amendment and then attempt to answer that. I'm not sure if I really can, but the amendment is purely technical. It's essentially the same definition as the bill currently has, but it puts it in law as opposed to referring to rule. In terms of what centers are licensed under that. It's clearly the big centers, the ones that, you know, that have their own location and
more than 10 children.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. I'm sorry. I don't really know that much about Chapter 245A in terms of what's licensed, but it does depend on the facility size and things like that.
Okay.
Family daycare can be 5 or it can be 10.
This
but
is
once you
10.
Go over 10, then it's center care.
Okay.
Very good. All right. On Senator Higgins' motion on the A4 amendment, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed? Motion passes. Senator Berglund, are there other amendments?
Yeah. Then there's an A5 amendment, which actually does deal with school bus stops. And what Senate Counsel has pointed out to me is that the current law that we have regarding prostitution being an enhanced crime does apply to school bus zones. But the laws dealing that relate to drug dealing do not. So this amendment would make those two things consistent.
And Senator Berglund and members, Senator Berglund, when you were not here the other day, we did talk about this inconsistency in the committee. Committee members, we've talked about this point. Does anybody have questions for Senator Berglund on this? We did talk about this inconsistency. Senator Higgins?
Sure.
Senator Higgins moved the A5 amendment. Is there any further discussions? Senator Neville.
Madam Chair, this doesn't change then. We're still keeping public transit in the bill. This only is adding an additional definition. Okay, so we're broadening the bill. Okay.
Yes. All right. Senator Neville. All right, all those in favor of the A5 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, say nay. The amendment passes. Is there another amendment, Senator
Berglund?
Yeah,
then there's an A6 amendment. And this amendment deals with an inconsistency in the existing law regarding public housing, where I believe drug dealing is covered, but prostitution is not. So this amendment would simply make both of those be covered in a consistent way.
Again, members, this is one of the inconsistencies that we talked about the other day, and this amendment refers to on page 5, in the section on prostitution crimes, Senator Berglund is adding public housing to that section.
I'll move that, Madam Chair.
Any questions? All right. On the A6 amendment, as moved by Senator Higgins, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. The motion passes. Any other amendments, Senator Berglund?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think we've gotten it all worked through now. And I guess what I can say is I think this is probably a good bill because we've made the law a lot more consistent now. And my constituents would be very happy if we would pass it because they are out there trying to monitor and patrol these school bus stops every morning to keep the kids safe from this kind of thing happening. And you know, if they can put some signs up that warn people that these zones will carry a heavier penalty, they believe that it would have a deterrent effect.
Senator Berglund, the other day when your witnesses were here, obviously the area where they're very concerned about was in the bus stop zones or the public transit zones. And could you share with us a little bit on the crisis nursery zone? There wasn't anybody of the witnesses who spoke to this issue.
Well, some of the children are picked up when they go to school from a daycare center.
Okay.
So the school buses come there. And so it isn't just kids going out to wait for a bus on the street by their house. So that, I think, is a thought about why you would want to include the child care center in the definition, because many children go to childcare before they go to school, and then they catch the school bus right outside of the childcare center.
And then the crisis nursery zones, Senator Berglund?
The crisis nurseries are places where children are brought when their parents are in crisis. Maybe the parents have a death in the family. They don't have a support system. They need some place where their children can be safe. They deal with their crisis. And so it's the same issue where those children then are picked up to go to school right outside the crisis center.
Any other questions for Senator Berglund from the members? Seeing none. Senator Olson.
Madam Chair, Senator Berglund, one of the things we talked about last time your bill was presented, I think it was after you were out of the room, was the definition regarding public transit stop zone and our concern that in downtown areas there may be one of these stops or zones every block. In essence, since you say that it includes anything within one block of each of these stops, that you would basically be making most or all of the downtown area fall within the definition of this bill. And we were concerned if that was your intent, and if it was, whether that might be making this so broad that it would dilute the effectiveness of it.
Senator Berglund.
Madam Chair and Senator Olson, my concern and the complaints that I have received are not from downtown Minneapolis. And, in fact, downtown Minneapolis has a pretty good system of cameras all over on every block down there. So people are not as likely to be engaging in these activities down there, because if they do, it's going to be on camera. My concern is out in the neighborhoods. I don't know how to, you know, I don't know what way there would be. I mean, we have never gotten to the point where we had legislation that is kind of, it's been city-specific, but it's never kind of exempted parts of the city. So I mean, if you wanted to exempt the downtown area, I don't object to that. I just don't know exactly how to do it, because I don't think I've ever seen a bill that did it before.
Senator Foley.
thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Berglund, is there any enforcement component dealing with this, or any kind of patrol or guardian angels or any of that that's likely to be helpful in those areas that you're now designating?
Senator Berglund.
Madam Chair and Senator Foley, the neighborhood has tried to engage the police during the hours that children are catching school buses. And sometimes they are successful, and sometimes the police have other things they can't attend to this issue.
Madam Chair, Senator Berglund, I was hoping that there would be some kind of a neighborhood group or something that would be less costly or not costly at all, volunteers, in order to observe something and then call in. I know the police are undermanned, and so we're never likely to get what you need there.
We have had, especially along Bloomington Avenue, for numbers of years, volunteer squads that go out in the morning, you know, set up a little table with coffee for people and go out and regularly patrol the bus stop areas. And it's early in the morning. I mean, I've gone out with them sometimes, and I really have to say, you know, the people that do this every day, I admire them, because, you know, they're starting at like 5:30 in the morning. And it's hard for anybody to really understand how this stuff can be happening at 5:30 in the morning, but it is. I mean, I've been there, I've seen it myself, and they're trying to capture the rush hour to work crowd, you know, stop for a quickie of this or a quickie of that, and, you know, and I mean, it's happening right in front of the kids, and of course, the people engaged in this are, you know, they're dangerous in that sometimes they're armed. So we do have volunteers. You know, it's it's a lot to ask for people, you know, who already have a lot of problems in their own lives to, you know, expect volunteers to be there all the time to do this for the kids. I think the hope that they have is that, you know, some of these folks will get arrested in these zones and get a little bit heavier sentence, and they will have relief for a while off the street from that individual harassing that group of children.
Senator Higgins.
Madam Chair, I can't remember what I was going to say, so I guess it couldn't
Senator
have been very important.
I think you wanted to move the bill.
Maybe that was it. Okay.
Yes. There was a Leslie Davis who had said that she'd like to testify on the bill. Are you here to testify for?
He's here.
He's right here.
Oh. Did you want to testify for the bill or against the bill?
A clarification of the problem. Well, say against then if you need it.
Do you want this bill to pass or are you here to ask us not to pass the bill?
Irrelevant.
Okay, come up and talk to us.
Okay, Mr. Leslie, come on up. Members, just so that you know, I like to have our agenda be done by 5:45 when we go to the convention. If it's not, once that's finished, we're all back here. So, Mr. Leslie.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It's Davis
Mr.
is
Davis.
My last
Mr.
name,
Davis.
Leslie Davis. And I've been a resident of the Lowry-Lindale corner for the last 10 years. It's probably the roughest corner in the state of Minnesota. I use the post office on Lowry. I take the bus back and forth. I don't own a vehicle. I probably know more about the drug prostitution problem and the solutions to it than anybody in the state of Minnesota because I experience it on a daily basis. I don't encourage drugs. I don't support the idea or anything to do with that. But we're not getting at the core of the problem. There's a group that formed and I've been in touch with, and they're all discussing the issue of drugs and talking about the need to deal with the drug issue as you must, and it's going to be a state-of-the-art kind of mind-changing thing for you to deal with, you must legalize the drugs in order to get control of them and keep them away from the children. This information comes to me not out of the air. You could bring people in, Norm Stamper, former police chief in Seattle, Chief Jerry Oliver from Detroit, Michigan, Jack Cole, a former narcotics under officer from New Jersey State Patrol, even the guy from Rand Scotland Yard Narcotics. They're all calling for the legalization of drugs because this is not solving the problem. You could chase them and push them around from corner to corner and put restrictions on them and arrest them, but if you legalize the drugs, then you're really getting at the core of the problem because the users are going to use and the children are going to get them more today by it not being legal because the drug dealer doesn't care the age of the children, but just like cigarettes or alcohol or whatever, if there were restrictions on it and the vendors were vending it, then it would be watched out for. These folks all talk about the fact that if you legalize the drugs, you take the crime out of it. The homes and streets would be safer. The methamphetamine labs would close, meaning the toxic chemicals wouldn't be out there. They'd be dealt with properly. You'd unclog the courts, reduce the prison population, save billions of dollars nationally, and then you'd increase the education system, expand treatment, reduce hepatitis, AIDS, other sexually transmitted diseases. That's what you need to do.
Mr. Davis? The bill, I understand where you're going with it, and I don't mean to not allow you to testify, but we have a bill here that is asking for us to create these safe zones for kids. And so do you want to give us your opinion on whether these safe zones are a good idea or a bad idea? I think the conversation and the policy discussion around legalization of drugs is a separate conversation that we will need more than the next 10, 15 minutes in order to engage in.
Right.
And we will welcome you back when we have that conversation for your input.
I appreciate that. And what I'm simply trying to do is plant the seed. And I don't think that this bill will mean anything about the problem in terms of the drugs. The prostitution, I don't understand that area quite as well. But in the drug issue, I don't think it's really going to mean anything. It's not protecting the kids.
Thank you, and I think Senator Berglund recognizes that. I think every member in this committee recognizes that. There are bigger solutions that we need to be looking at in addition to what this is attempting to do.
Are you going to be doing that in the future, Madam Chair? Is that something I'm not aware of that's going to be happening?
Mr. Davis, we will take every good idea that comes into this legislature and give it due consideration.
Then I'll be in touch with you, and I thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you for coming. It's good to have your input. Any further discussions with Senator Berglund on Senate File 1179? Senator Higgins renews her motion that Senate File 1179, as amended, be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Finance.
Why does it go to Finance?
Grants at the end.
What?
Well, and debt impacts, possibly.
Senator Berglund, I believe you have a grant.
Yes, I forgot about that.
I requested that. So that's why. On that motion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion passes.
Thank you.
The next item on the agenda is, thank you, Senator Berglund, Senate File 148. Is Senator Marty here yet? Senator Marty is not here yet. We will. I see Mr. Burt Black in the audience. Is Senator Torres Ray here yet? She's not here yet. Well, I guess maybe we. Is Senator Sparks here? He's not here. Senator Betzel?
Does Ms. Ponius have an amendment? I think. We're on council. I have a mine's a brief matter, but I need an amendment from council now, Madam Chair.
Senator Betzel, they all say that.
No. I'm working on it, so.
She just went to grab the amendment. We'll take Senator Betzel.
Okay.
Here's Senator Marty. Here's Senator Marty is here. Well, we'll take Senator Marty. Senator Betzel knows he's in the committee. We'll get to him.
Yep. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Senate File 148 is a major mental health initiative. It's got to go through several committees, but Article 1 is the one that relates to this committee particularly. And it accomplishes several things. First of all, I guess fairly new creation is this crisis intervention teams for law enforcement, because often when you have people with mental illness confronting law enforcement, there is a misunderstanding that occurs, and sometimes the person with mental illness, when confronted, responds based on their mental illness, and the law enforcement folks take it as an aggressive act towards them, so it escalates and becomes a terrible situation. A number of law enforcement departments, I believe Minneapolis Police Department among others, have created crisis intervention teams and provided training, and it's been very helpful working together. This would create a state council to encourage and support development of these crisis intervention teams statewide. That's what Section 1 would do. The second provision would be we're setting up an intake procedure for mental health screening. When you enter a jail, there would be a procedure, very brief, I believe it's a few minutes screening for mental health, which is a big problem that many times people with mental illness issues go into prison or jail and it's not recognized what the problem is. And so it would help a lot in providing services and appropriate help for the person. Section 3 would be grants for reentry into the community.
Senator Marty, let me interrupt you, and I'm sorry I didn't say this beforehand, but I believe, Senator Marty, Section 3 is a project that has already not been heard by this committee, but I believe been heard by Senator Higgins' committee.
Yes.
And has already been laid over for possible inclusion in her omnibus bill.
We don't need to go over that.
I don't think we need to. I believe, Senator Marty, the only sections that are appropriate for this committee to consider are sections 1, 2, and 4. So if you can focus on those sections, and then, Senator Marty, it would help me a lot if your testifiers could just speak to those sections.
They were aware of that. I'm sorry.
Thank you.
I mistook Section 3 as being one that was for this committee. Yep. Section 4 is to require the Department of Corrections to develop a protocol for dealing with inmates who are being sent to some sort of disciplinary confinement. Unfortunately, unless there's a plan in place, and the department's totally in charge of what the plan is, but sometimes that person put into a disciplinary punishment, they act up more and it escalates, and again, they would have to have a procedure to help the person so they can get out. It would be for the good of the inmate and the institution. Those are the three provisions that are before this committee. I have Sue Abderholden, who's the executive director of NAMI Minnesota, and I believe one other witness as well.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Sue Abderholden, executive director of NAMI Minnesota. And I just want to state that we are firmly in support of this provision, of the whole bill, of course, because too often we see people with mental illness coming into the criminal justice system, and it's unrecognized, undiagnosed, untreated. The mental health screening document, it's a free tool developed by the Gaines Center, so it doesn't cost anything. You can actually just print it off from the Internet. It's very short. It just takes a couple of minutes at the most, depending on how fast you talk. You don't have to be a mental health professional to deliver it. This can be done by the jail staff, and in some ways it's a safety issue for the jail staff as well, because once you have flagged someone, you might watch that person a little bit more closely in terms of suicide risk or something of that sort. So we think it's an important provision. In terms of the people being kept in disciplinary confinement, people can be in there for a very, very long time. And every time you have another infraction and break the rule, you get time added on. And so the time just kind of keeps building up, and there's no way to kind of get out of it. And to be honest, for people who have a serious mental illness who are in confinement, you know, and it can be for, you know, most of the day, that can really exacerbate their mental illness symptoms.
Thank you. Senator Marty, do you have any other testifiers on the bill?
We have one more person, I believe.
And then Mark.
Do you want the CIT?
Yes, real quick. I'm sure.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you. My name is Judy Gilo, and I'm from Winona, Minnesota. Madam Chair and members of the committee, I am Judy Gilo. I have a 39-year-old son, Bob, who has a mental illness. We also lost a son to suicide almost 3 years ago. Bob was a happy, active child, very active, and he was put on Ritalin in about fifth grade, because back then that was the solution, was Ritalin. As he got older, he ran into trouble and ended up in the juvenile justice system. I was told he was a behavioral problem, but I felt that there was something else going on. I talked to teachers, I talked to anyone and everyone, social services, jail administrators, but no one would listen to me that there was something more there. At 16, he was put on in-school suspension, and one of his teachers asked him if he was going to quit school now that he was old enough, or stay around and aggravate them. And since he wasn't feeling particularly successful in school, he thought that sounded like a good idea. He might as well quit. So after he turned 18, he got into trouble again, and this time I talked with the county attorney. Unfortunately, the county attorney took this information into court and used it against my son. I was looking to get help for him, and the county attorney turned it around and used it to send him into prison. Since then, Bob has been in and out of prison. During this time, it was nearly impossible to get anyone's interest into what was really going on with Bob. It took a long time to get a mental health assessment, and that was only after Bob had pinned his dad down on the sidewalk. They wanted us to press charges, but we just wanted to help for our son, and every time Bob went to prison, he came out worse. We knew that punishment wasn't the answer. Bob would get better, go off his medications, become worse, get into prison, get even worse, and get released. The cycle was awful, and it was hard on our whole family. The last time he was in prison was about 2 years ago. He was discharged to a motel. He stayed there for a couple weeks, decided he couldn't afford that, and he became homeless, living in the woods by the lake. One rainy day, a police officer saw Bob sitting by a bridge, soaked and alone. The officer radioed that he couldn't stand to see my son sitting there in the cold rain, so he picked him up and brought him into the ER. I went to the ER, brought a picture I had of Bob, and I asked the ER doctor, "Does the man in front of you look anything like the man in the picture?" Because the picture I had was when Bob was on his meds and was normal. Bob looked terrible. He had trench foot. He was dirty, wet, and clearly very ill. Only then were we able to get him back on his meds. For discharge planning, when they're in prison, they only need to provide an address. So he would provide the address, he would get out, and so we'd go through this cycle again. A lot of money has been spent on my son, attorneys, judges, jail, prison costs, but very little on the things that would help him recover. No one wanted to assess him after he was out of jail or prison without a court order, and then that goes back to the whole court thing again, or provide him with long-term stable housing and community supports. Also, probation officers need proper mental health training to be able to deal with their clients, which at this point they do not have. There is a lot in this bill that would have helped my son: mental health screening, discharge planning out of jails and prisons, and mental health courts. I love my son, and I will continue to try to advocate for him, but I want our systems to start recognizing people like my son, people who have a serious mental illness who cannot function successfully in our communities because we do not provide housing, jobs, and community supports that are so needed for recovery. I don't even want to think about what my son's life could have been like had he been identified and diagnosed and provided community supports. Please support this bill and give people with a serious mental illness like my son a chance for a better life. Now, this is a very short version of a very, very long story, but I thank you for letting me share it.
Thank you for coming. As a mother, I admire your courage and your unconditional love for your child. Thank you for sharing your story.
Madam Chair, I also have Mark Anderson from the Barbara Schneider Foundation, which is the group that started working on these crisis intervention teams.
My name is Mark Anderson. I'm executive director of Barbara Schneider Foundation. My organization is focused on supporting the development of CIT training and on the development of collaborations between mental health, criminal justice, emergency medicine, and advocacy in communities around Minnesota. My board is made up primarily of individuals with a family member with a serious mental illness and of individuals who themselves are struggling with a serious mental illness. We support this bill because we found CIT to be a model that has improved mental health crisis response in Minnesota. CIT training has provided an opportunity for law enforcement professionals, mental health community members, and others to respond to those at risk for mental health crisis, to come together to develop partnerships that improve our response to mental health crisis calls and to help us prevent these calls. This initiative gives officers the tools they need to respond to mental health crisis calls, and we think the development of CIT in local police departments provides a venue for the department for the development of improved relationships between mental health, courts, corrections, law enforcement, emergency medicine, and social service professionals in communities. Thanks.
Thank you, Mr. Anderson. Are there any questions for this witness? Senator Marty.
Madam Chair, I also have Michael Peterson, who's the executive director of the CIT Officers Association of Minnesota.
Welcome to committee, Mr. Peterson.
Thank you very much. My name is Michael Peterson. I'm a retired sergeant from the Burnsville Police Department, and I'm currently practicing as a licensed associate marriage and family therapist. I currently serve also as the executive director of the Minnesota CIT Officers Association, and I'm actively involved in providing CIT training or crisis intervention team training to officers throughout the state of Minnesota. So I wear both a hat of police officer, sergeant, and a mental health professional here today. CIT is a growing national model in law enforcement. Interest in CIT has grown dramatically in the last year here in Minnesota. Our association is made up of CIT officers who have been through the training and have experienced what the CIT training has been available, and police chiefs, police officers have filled those classes oftentimes. But there's a lack of funding. Police officers are frequently called to respond to mental health related calls, and police officers are not mental health professionals. CIT training covers a wide variety of topics, including introduction to mental illness, mood disorders, thought disorders, anxiety disorders, phobias, and personality disorders. We cover de-escalation techniques and officer safety, mobile crisis teams, family and consumer panels, suicide by cop, civil commitment, and many more topics. Each day of the training, we do scenario-based role-playing play training where professional actors act out the role of the individuals in crisis, and the officers practice responding, guided by skilled law enforcement coaches in CIT. This hands-on role-playing is very effective because it teaches the officers what to do when they open the squad car and the mental health crisis call begins. You can see this is good training, but it is expensive, and that becomes a barrier to many departments. I strongly support this legislation because it will help local law enforcement departments that have a limited training budget. Plus, it provides a venue for conversation between leaders in law enforcement and mental health on how we can work together to continually improve police services when it involves responding to mental health crisis calls. Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Marty, where is the I'm looking here in the bill, and I'm looking to where the CIT State Council will be housed. Is it contemplated it will be housed in the Department of Public Safety, or is it going to be with the Post Board? Mr. Anderson?
I believe the summary said the Department of Public Safety. I think we were, I was sort of thinking Post Board, which I don't know where more logical is. Senator Ford?
I would not do that, Madam Chair. The Post Board deals with licensure and training of people. It doesn't deal with supervising work groups and that sort of thing.
I think
you may want the Post Board to set standards as to the what training would be appropriate, but beyond that, I don't think.
Senator Marty, are we in some way thinking about the CIT State Council as perhaps an entity along the line of, say, the councils of color, where it would be kind of a standalone entity then? I don't see any direct references to where it would be housed, and if we're not, it doesn't say the Post Board or the Department of Public Safety.
Madam Chair, I do notice it has the Commissioner of Public Safety making the appointments to the council. I don't know. That would seem to be a reasonable place. I was, again, the reason for Post Board, because this involves training, but I understand Senator Foley's point. And the main point, I don't think it needs to be independent. I think it should be under the department or someplace.
And Senator Marty, correct me if I'm wrong, but you're not asking for appropriations for this council. There's no.
We were hoping for, we would like to have some in, there is a provision here for grants to be, it's in section 5. Section 5, subdivision 4, it was $144,000 to the Commissioner of Public Safety. Again, that's probably why Senate Council assumes it's in there, which makes sense, to fund grants to local police departments to conduct this. So it was not for the council. The funding was for grants.
Correct. So we're establishing a council, and you provided the membership of that council. And then you're asking for grants to local police officers who presumably would be paying for the training, but is the assumption here is that the council will be providing all the training, and thereby the grants will come back and fund the council?
Yeah, I could clarify, Anderson. We've been doing it. I think the grants would go to a local law enforcement agency, and the law enforcement agency would hire the trainers to come in and provide the training. There's a CIT Officers Association here in Minnesota, which you just heard from, that is providing this training now. And so that we have the capability to provide the training. This would provide local police chiefs the assistance they need to be able to afford to provide it.
So for the time being, Senator Marty, you're creating a council. I'm not asking you to, but there's no appropriation earmarked to help them run. I'm assuming that the individuals who are named as members in the council will then be doing the work of the council on a voluntary basis.
Madam Chair, I had not thought of it, but yes, there's no funding for per diems even. But which is obviously why it would have to be under the department. I think it would be appropriate to have a small appropriation in there, but since this bill is going to Finance Committee, that is something we should be taking care of. Make sure there's a small appropriation. I don't know that this has to be going on an ongoing basis, but at least initially to make sure we have a good system in place.
And Senator Marty, let me point out to you that on page 2, line 15, or subdivision 3, you do have it in the bill that the council shall have at least one employee who shall be responsible for coordination of the statewide CIT training for public safety officers. So I think what I would like, Senator Marty, and if the members are open to this, since this bill will be traveling to state and local, that why don't you and the different stakeholder groups talk about this? And I would hate to thrust this into the responsibility of the Department of Public Safety without having them fully having a discussion with you.
Sure, that's a good point. We will take care of it before the next committee.
Before you get to that, if that's all right with the members of the committee. I think this is clearly in the jurisdiction of the State Government Operations Policy Committee to look at in terms of the composition and the jurisdiction and the running of this council. So why don't you take care of that piece? Can we hear from the post board? Are you? I thought I had heard. I just want this on the record. We had asked whether the post board is all right that we're statutorily putting them on this council. Maybe they're not here. You might want them to, again, appear at the next committee, even if just to put that on the record. And then I think the Department of Corrections is here. Yes.
On that point, I have had conversation with Neil Melton, the director of the post board, and from my conversation, he is supportive of this bill. He's supportive of this agenda and them being involved in the objectives of this council.
All right. And then the Department of Corrections, is the department here? Your name is mentioned in a couple of places, and we like your input.
Madam Chair, thank you for the record. My name is Nanette Larson. I'm the Director of Health Services for the Department of Corrections. And with respect to the disciplinary confinement and, of course, the intake screening tool, we are very, very sensitive to the mentally ill being in prison. We have lots of staff that are devoted to providing services for our mentally ill. We provide great training to our officers how to handle our mentally ill offenders. But I wanted to clarify a couple of facts. This disciplinary confinement protocol just relates to disciplinary confinement. We have a couple of other segregation status in our system. We have administrative segregation, which allows us to place an offender into segregation for his or her own protection. And might be because there are more behavioral issues. We want to keep them safe from themselves, safe from the other offenders. We also allow offenders who are on segregation status, if there is a severe mental illness, to be placed in our mental health units, both at Shakopee and at Oak Park Heights. And that way we have our mental health staff keeping an eye on them on a pretty much 24/7 basis. And so with that, we have been working with NAMI really very closely on this language as well as some of the other pieces of this that relate to the Department of Corrections. So just wanted to clarify a couple points.
And Ms. Larson, just for the record, a number of us have been on tours, and we are aware of the different protocols and the different segregations that take place. But I think that, a point has been well made that the discharging issues and the disconnect and some of the gaps from discharge and then having the people in the community and the access to medication and the continuity of care, that is an ongoing issue. And I know that the Department of Corrections is concerned about that, wants to do something about that, as well as this committee. So I have a question for you, Ms. Larson, with respect to page 2, subdivision 3A, section 2, subdivision 3A, with a reference to the intake procedure for new prisoners. And the mental health screening tool, do you already have something like that in place?
Madam Chair, yes, we do have a screening tool. When our offenders either come to St. Cloud or to Shakopee, they are greeted by health services staff, and we have a series of questions. I actually have a copy of the tool that we use, but they have a series of questions that they ask with respect to the mental health inquiries. It's, have you ever been seen by a psychologist or a psychiatrist, and of course, what for? They're kind of high-level questions. Have you ever been hospitalized for mental health reasons? Have you ever attempted suicide? If any of those boxes then are checked yes, that automatically flags the offender then to be seen by our mental health staff. And we have a much more comprehensive admission health screening tool that we use. But that needs to be used by mental health professionals.
Ms. Larson, so at the current time, do you have any health screening tool that would be available to local corrections officials?
Madam Chair, we'd be happy to make both of these tools available to them.
Then I think that this is going to be helpful to make that happen. This won't be too onerous on you, Ms. Larson.
Oh, Madam Chair, it won't be too much at all.
Very good. Yeah. Any other questions for the witnesses? Senator Marty, we'll rely on the fact that you'll address the other issues.
Thank you for pointing them out, Madam Chair. All right.
Senator Olson moves that. Are there any people in the audience who would like to testify on either for or against this sections 1, 2, and 4 of this bill? Seeing none. Senator Olson moves that Senate File 148, as amended, be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on State Government, State and Local Government
Operations
and Oversight. And Oversight. Any discussions? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay.
Thank
Motion
you,
passes.
Chair, members of the committee.
Now, let's see. Is Senator Sparks in the room? Senator Butzel, I think you get to go.
Yes, I can do that.
Last time. Stephanie called Senator Sparks. I'm Senator.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. Senate File 276 is actually going to be a bill that's familiar to every member of this committee in one way or another. It's the statewide health insurance pool. Actually, Senator Scheid and Senator Olson spent about 4 hours in the Commerce Committee reviewing it, and other members may recognize it as an issue that was on the Senate floor for a vote in the past. The issue before this committee is quite limited, and I do have the A-12 amendment to deal with. There's a data practices issue, and I'll briefly describe what the bill does, but we're only looking at one very small part of the bill. This would create a statewide pool for health insurance for school districts. There would be governed by a board of directors that you can see it described at the top of page 2. And it would provide initially 6 health plans to the school districts throughout the state. They say it's more of an insurance and a health care bill. The reason why the bill is before this committee on page 3, lines 28 to 33, it refers to the board that's being created having information about the non-identifiable data on the employees there, and it makes a reference to statutes 13.203. Well, the A-2 amendment actually would amend section the Data Practices Act 13.203, which is an existing law dealing with service co-ops that collect data, and all that the A-1 amendment does is would put this plan into that collection of data. Mainly the information they collect on school employees would be not public data, but it may be disclosed if the directors of service co-ops or this board determines that the release of data would not be detrimental to the plan of the program. This is strictly a data protection issue. It is obviously they're collecting data on individuals, and the general law in the state is that if data is collected, it is normally public data. There are reasons why when we're dealing with individuals and health insurance issues, the data they're collecting is not
intended to be public, and in fact, it's not even going to be identifiable as to individual. If you even identify an individual by a birth date in some small town, you'd be identifying the person. So it's not the intention of this plan to be identifying people. But they, in order to make the plan work, they have to be able to have access to data. And this basically protects the data that is being collected, similar to what is already in law. That's the only issue why it is before this committee, Madam Chair. I've already shared the amendment, I believe, with the major the individuals who I believe are here on it. I've indicated that this is the only issue before this committee. As I indicated, we had a long discussion in the Commerce Committee. This bill is ultimately going to the Health, Housing, and Family Security Committee, where I'm sure there's going to be more discussions on the health care aspects there. But I'm not aware that anybody has an interest, one way or the other, on the data issue that brought it before this committee.
Any questions to Senator Betzel on the A-12 amendment? Senator Betzel, all right, because it's a new amendment. Is there anybody in the audience who would like to speak specifically on the A-12 amendment?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Excuse me, my name is Phil Griffin. I represent Preferred One of the health plans here in town. And Senator Betzel was kind enough to share the amendment with us beforehand, and I have not had a chance to talk with him. And I know nobody expects that this pool might fail at some future date, but if, in fact, we're pulling all of this data into Chapter 13 and saying that this board gets to make the decisions on where data moves, should we at some point in the future have this entity fail, there's not going to be any underwriting data available to anybody else who might want to take over and try and work with these groups. I'd like to work with Senator Betzold as we move forward. I don't have any ideas for legislation and language at this point in time, but it's an issue that I think we need to think about as we move forward. This may not turn out as well as everybody hopes, and we just want to be cautious as we move forward. I appreciate the time of the committee members and Senator Betzold's thoughts, and be happy to take any questions.
Senator Betzold, have you already heard this
I've heard that concern, but I'll be, if there's ways to allay that, I quite frankly haven't even thought of how it's going to fail when I haven't even got it started yet. But but it's a legitimate question, and as I say, we're amending the service co-ops statute, and you know the issue could very well be applicable to them too. And it's an issue that crosses a lot of different jurisdictions, and it's beyond just the scope of this committee, and I don't have the answer to it right now, Madam Chair, but certainly something that probably does merit some consideration, but we'll have to see where it goes. But
That being said, Senator Betzel, you still want to move on the A-12 amendment?
I think I'd have to move the A-12 amendment, yeah, Madam Chair.
All right.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Mr. Griffin, we will. Your comments are on the record. Senator Betzel will work with you on addressing those. Anybody else in the audience who would like to testify on the A-12 amendment? Any questions from the members to Senator Betzel on the A-12 amendment? Senator Betzel moves the A-12 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion passes. I believe that's the bill, members. Does anybody in the audience want to testify in just this specific provision of the bill, either for or against? Any questions from the members to Senator Betzel on this provision of the bill? Seeing none, Senator Betzel moves that Senate File 276, as amended, be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Health,
Housing
Family Security Committee. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion passes.
Madam Chair, members.
Senator Torres Ray.
Okay, see you out there.
Senator Torres Ray, this is your first appearance before this committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you to the committee. It's just really an honor to be here. So thank you for giving me the opportunity.
And you bring with you a very distinguished name.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And very knowledgeable. And I'm very pleased because half of what I will be presenting, I'm still learning. So I'm pleased to be accompanied by a person who really knows these issues and who will be able to respond to your questions. So thank you for this opportunity, Madam Chair. Madam Chair and members of the committee, I'm presenting Senate File 1346. And this is a very technical bill that is proposed by the Secretary of State. And we do this every year, and it's basically to look at compliance and looking at the language that we have in place today. The goals that we have for today are to look at three issues. Consistency, flexibility, and equity are the three things that the Secretary of State is trying to accomplish today. Consistency is mainly for making sure that Minnesota businesses will file their reports in compliance with the law, and that will provide the Secretary of the State and therefore the public with information that is needed to conduct their business. And flexibility in accommodating new online filing methods that we are very pleased that the office is pursuing right now, and as you know, that really helps all of us become more efficient. So, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I will ask for your support, and I have with me Mr. Black, who will be talking about this bill, and I understand that Senator Linda Higgins has an amendment, which I'm pleased to accept, so we will proceed with that first, and then Mr. Black will walk you through the bill.
Why don't we have Mr. Black, why don't you take us through the bill as is, and then if there are, unless I'm not aware that there's an author's amendment on the table. No. So why don't you walk us through the sections of the bill, and then if members desire to do amendments, we'll address that.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Bert Black. I'm the legal advisor for the Office of the Secretary of State, and this is not my first appearance before the committee. But I'm pleased to be here just as much as Senator Torres Ray. This is, as she said, our housekeeping bill. We come by the legislature every now and again with things that we have found that are inconsistent. This year, we are focusing on these provisions because we are in the process of moving from our 1985 Sperry Univac program, which we are still on, to a rewrite to something more modern. And so in the process of doing that, you know, we've looked at, we want to make sure that things are the same, because if you have to write special programs for different provisions, it costs a lot of money these days to do that. And so we have a number of provisions. Let me walk you through the bill. There are two articles in the bill. Article 1 is about business entities, and Article 2 is about certain aspects of the legal effect of notarizations. We'll start with Article 1. Section 1 deals with assumed name fees. For some reason, since time immemorial, assumed name copy fees have been different from the copy fees for everybody else. We do about 600 of these copies a year, so it's not a lot, because we do about 24,000 total. This changes the charge to be the same, which is $3 for the articles of incorporation, or the initial filing, and $3 for any amendments. Previously, it had been $3 for the entire assumed name record. So this is it is a small fee increase, I will say that, but of $3 to about 600 people a year. So it doesn't raise a whole lot of money, I will say that. Then we get into a number of sections about annual reports. Section 2 is regarding business corporation annual reports, and this is going to ensure that we have the same process for administrative dissolution. Right now, business corporations file every year, but they're only dissolved after they miss 2 years. For all the other business entities, generally speaking, it's after you've missed 1 year, and these are calendar year filings. So we're trying to make the process the same for the businesses as it is for nonprofits and other similar limited liability companies and other similar organizations. We also have a provision here that makes it unnecessary to file or to give notice after dissolution, because the notice is given before dissolution. that they need to file each year or face dissolution. So, and that is, that doesn't have any deleterious effect on the business corporation because they have an unlimited time in which to reinstate. We changed that law a number of years ago so that they have forever to come back and reinstate. Also, we no longer have to send a letter to the Attorney General and the Commissioner of Revenue telling them where our list of dissolved corporations is because they really know where it is now after 5 or 6 years of having it online. Then we go into a number of sections about co-ops, both producer and consumer co-ops and investor co-ops. And we've talked with the folks from the representing cooperatives. We are working with them on Sections 3 and 5. Sections 3 and 5 provide that the report would be annual instead of every 2 years. They understand our concerns, and we are talking with each other. Section 4 is strikes that mandate to send a letter that we had in Section 2, because they know where that list is as well. Section 6 is the same as Section 4. Section 4 is for producer and consumer co-ops. Section 6 is for investor co-ops. Section 7 is a very odd provision in current law, which says you have to file your first annual report when you file your articles of organization. Legally speaking, that's not possible because you don't know who your chief executive officer is at the time you file your articles. And this was in the original 308B, when 308B was put in, well, now it's several years ago. And we're just now getting around to looking at that. So that's the folks at the co-ops agree that that doesn't make any sense. Section 8 is regarding cooperative dissolution. When you dissolve a company, and this is the same for business corporations, nonprofits, LLCs, and other entities in Minnesota, first you file a notice of intent to dissolve. And that puts people on notice that you're about to go away. And unless you pay everybody off, pardon me, let me rephrase that. Unless you resolve all your debts, you have to wait a certain period of time. Well, it turns out the notice of intent to dissolve is actually referenced three times, I believe, in 308B, but it is never actually defined. We think that was just a missed section when we did 308B. So this is the language that's in the producer and consumer co-ops, and it just makes sure that there's a definition of what the filing of the notice of intent to dissolve is. Section 9 is also sort of an oddball situation, and this is a provision that's also supported by the state auditor. Section 9, about 20 years ago, we had a state representative who was a firefighter, a very nice fellow. I won't name any names. He had the idea, probably correct at the time, that, you know, these are small organizations. They shouldn't be burdened with excessive paper, and they're already reporting to the state auditor. So why do we need to do this, what was then a new report, to the Secretary of State? And so the state auditor was directed to basically copy the information and send it to us. And that would be the report, the annual report for the Volunteer Firefighter Relief Associations. Now we have our report online. And as it turns out, the state auditor does exactly the opposite. They tell the Firefighter Relief Associations to go to our webpage, fill out the report online, and then they go to the website, the public website. They print off the information from our annual report, and they use that. They put that in their file at the state auditor. Now, of course, the state auditor collects a lot of other information too. They collect all the financial information. We don't get that, but they use this. They use our information as the basis, the start of their file. So we're just trying in Section 9 to make the law conform to actual practice. Section 10. Talks about a fee paid by limited partnerships. First of all, we wanted to clarify that there is no fee for the annual report. We do not charge fees for annual reports for Minnesota entities. We do charge for non-Minnesota corporations, and that's a fairly substantial revenue stream, but we don't charge for Minnesota organizations. And so we wanted to make sure that, that the language clarifies that, because it does indicate that it talks about a blanket fee for other filings. Finally, in Section 10, or not finally, but in Section 10, we also change the name reservation fees to be the same for Minnesota and non-Minnesota organizations that want to file to protect a name, to reserve a name while they decide whether they want to come in and register and do business in Minnesota. So we want to make that fee the same. Section 11 talks about a process for recording the information by non-Minnesota limited partnerships when they change their names. For foreign corporations, if you change the name in the home state, you get a certificate of good of name change from the Secretary of State of the other state, and you file it with our office. And so we have a record of the new name, because people will they may have the new name and not the old name, and we want to keep our records current. We didn't previously have language in 321 to provide for that, so that's Section 11. Again, it's modeled after the foreign corporation statute that we already have. Sections 12, 13, and 14.
Mr. Black,
yes.
Can I interrupt you?
Yes.
On Section 10, with the fee reduction from 50 to 35, how many transactions of that nature takes place in a year?
Actually, very few. I should say that right now it's very few, because they can reserve the same name under the corporate law for $35. So I don't think we're going to see a reduction in revenue. But even if we did, there are only a few hundred of these each year. The price drives them to the other filing, which they are allowed to do.
Thank you.
Sections 12, 13, and 14 deal with the Uniform Commercial Code. As you know, we do secured transactions, financing statements under Article 9 of the Uniform Commercial Code. First, let me do Section 13. That's the provision that says that we can accept XML electronic format documents. Now, XML, I don't know, I'm not a technical person, but XML stands for Extensible Markup Language and is basically a way of doing bulk filings. Right now, we have online UCC filings, but you have to enter them in one at a time. Yes, I see wincing faces around the table. So that's, you understand that this is then an advance for people who have lots of transactions. They can put that in a data format and transmit it all at once, and it will automatically fill in the data fields at our office. It's much better for the customer if you have a lot of filings. Sections 12 and 14 deal with a situation regarding the online UCC filings. We started doing online UCC filings in 2004. When Article 9 was revised at great length and great effort back in the 90s, and the language actually passed in the 2000 session, the fee was $20 for both paper and, we didn't have online filings, frankly, at that time. When we went to online filings in 2004, we reduced, the legislature reduced the fee for online to $15. This is good for the customer, but Secretary of State's office does the online filings. Counties are still involved. We're one of two states in the nation where counties still take UCC filings. We're pleased to work with them. Their fee is for paper, which we do some paper too, but we mostly do online. Their fee is $20. So the counties have for some time been slightly upset about the fact that their fee is higher, and they would like to have a level playing field about the fee, because they feel that the discount drives business away from them. And for the counties, this is since they get to keep that fee, and they're budgeting for staff and other things on that fee, they are feeling it. And so Secretary Ritchie indicated in response to the request of the county is that, yes, we're going to equalize this fee. And the way that we're proposing to do it is to discontinue the discount for the online filings. We provide in Section 12, you notice it, in Section 14 it says that we will, that discontinuance of the discount results in an extra $5 per filing. And that $5 per filing is put into the Uniform Commercial Code account. That is a revolving fund account that we've had for many, 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 many years. Probably, I don't know, 15, 16, 17 years. And it's to be devoted in Section 12, devoted to the improvement of online services and the payment of remote payment fees for all business and UCC transactions. And the reason that that language is in there is because we are, when we move from our old 1985 Sperry Univac system to something newer, we are going to go to a remote payment model. That is to say, credit cards, e-checks, that kind of thing. When you take credit cards, as if some of you heard the, I think there was a report of the credit card task force some weeks ago. I think that was Mr. Keith Carlson. I don't know if it was in this committee or in another committee.
GovOps.
It was in, okay. That is an issue for state government. These two things are somewhat unrelated, but they happen to have good timing. The county issue, the fee issue, that's an equity issue. The credit card issue is going to come up in a major way starting for our office, starting in July when we move to this remote payments model and continuing into the future as far as we can see. And so we had the thought that let's use this money for the payment of the credit card fees, which we are going to be charged, because online payments, online transactions, as Senator Torres Ray indicated, are absolutely very popular, and that's going to be the way of the future. And I don't know how much I can go into more detail, but Senator Betzel might want me to save that for his committee.
How many of these transactions do takes place each year?
Calendar year 2006, we had, and the trend is up, 86,000. The trend is up. We expect that it'll be 100,000 in the next fiscal year. So it's very popular. Section 15 is the repealer, and the repealer is simply the other half of the volunteer firefighter provision that we had earlier, and that's a provision relating to these relief associations in the insurance sections. Section 16 provides for the effective dates. The portions regarding annual reports are for next calendar year, because we do those on a calendar year basis. Everything else other than the fiscal sections are the regular August 1st. Article 2 is regarding notaries. These are some provisions that were brought to us by the real property section of the Bar Association, and they deal with the clarifying the necessity of having the signer in the presence of the notary when doing an acknowledgement, which is not required, as opposed to when you are verifying, witnessing, or attesting a signature when it is required. There was some language put in, I think it was either 05 or 06, that made it not quite as clear about the presence necessary for verifying, witnessing, or attesting. And then the other thing that these sections on notaries do is they allow limited liability companies specifically to sign in a representative capacity. That's really comfort language, because there is language in there already that says, or other entity. But we have many, many, many limited liability companies now. In fact, we now get more limited liability company formations than corporate formations, interestingly enough. So we wanted to help the Bar Association and also certainly make it clear that they can sign in a representative capacity.
Mr. Black?
Yes.
Senator Betzel tells us that every elected legislator is a notary. Is that true?
They are. Yes, but
you better say yes.
Yes, but
I do it.
it's not. I mean, you don't have a stamp. You don't need a stamp. If you look at 358.15, and maybe counsel can help me if I'm I may have that wrong, but I believe that's a section. You can notarize. Every member of the legislature can notarize a document simply by signing Don Betzold. Senator,
well,
district.
I can. I mean, they
well. district 51. My term expires January 2, 2011. Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So on the card, my gave me. So.
Yeah, it's on your card. That's right. But yes, that is true. And in fact, there are a number of other officials who are notary can authenticate and take oaths simply by virtue of their office. For example, clerks of court, city clerks, I think county auditors, various county officials. It's all in Chapter 358 if you want to check out the list. But yes, all of you are able to do all those notarial acts.
Learn something every day, Senator Higgins.
I'm sure. I seem to have become the neighborhood notary, and so can I get a stamp that says whatever that is to do? Or do I have to handwrite out that by virtue of office, State Senator Blatt Blatt?
I think I don't remember that it says you have to handwrite it. Does it? Maybe counsel can advise. Or I can be in touch with you after the hearing.
Yeah, just
Senator Higgins, the statute actually is almost in a form. I bet if you print the statutory section, you could just use it as a form and just sign it.
I'll check into that. Thank you.
And the Secretary of State might want to think about, you know, maybe not at an extremely high cost, but maybe some creative way to formulate something like
to inform members of their powers.
See, along with our name tags, we can get
Senator Neville.
Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, Mr. Black, is our liability exactly the same as a regular notary that... don't they have to be bonded and the statute prescribes some liability if they mess up? Is our liability the same if we do it as a legislator?
Madam Chair, Senator Neville, that's a good question. I'll look into that. I don't know the answer. I suspect if you do the act, you're on the same, you know, the notarial act, you're probably subject to the same. But
Senator Olson,
check it out.
Madam Chair, Senator Neville, but isn't there something that exempts us from liability if we're doing something in the course of senatorial duties? And I don't know if this would fall under that or not.
That's okay. Get our jail free card.
Let's get back to the bill. I apologize. I took us off track. Mr. Black, back to Article 3 of the bill.
There is no Article 3.
In your desk today, or
are we done? Article 2, Section 3. Sorry. Well, wherever you are, Mr. Black.
Let's see. Oh, well, I actually covered the... I think I've covered all of Article 2, sort of not section by section, but generally speaking. So unless... I'll be glad to stand for questions from the members.
Senator Olson.
Madam Chair and Mr. Black, I just have one quick question going back to Section 3 of Article 1. Mm-hmm. If businesses are now required to file every year instead of every other year, is there a cost? I think there is a cost involved with that filing, and how much is that?
Actually, for the annual reports, there is no fee.
Oh, there is no fee.
Our plan is to have all the annual reports. Most of them are online. You can go online. It takes about 30 seconds, and I can tell you that we do about 87% of our annual reports online, and that's a total 87% out of 185,000 filings per year, and it has been wonderful.
Any further? Senator Higgins.
Madam Chair, I have the A1 amendment.
The A1 amendment.
And soon we will, too.
And soon you will, too. That's right. And while they're passing it out, Madam Chair, I think driven Ms. Potty is crazy this session because in my other life, in the other half of the year, I work for the regulatory agency for the city I live in. And I often have to try to find owners of properties. And more often, I find LLCs and LLPs who have bought a property, and they put, you know, if it's on 8th Avenue North, they'll put the 8th Avenue Partnership LLP, and then the address of the property as the partnership's property. And when I try to find them, if there's been a fire, an explosion, if there's a, you know, nuisance action I need to deal with them with or anything like that, there's no way of finding them unless they have come in and gotten their rental license for the property, at which time then we get all the contact information. So then I call over to Mr. Black and I say, can you find the 8th Avenue LLP? And he looks all over, and almost always he comes back and said, yeah, like that.
Yeah.
And so this...
for the record, can you describe what... when they transcribe this, it'll be hard to...
Okay. Once in a while, Mr. Black can find them, but usually he can't. Let's just say it that way.
It's not for lack of trying.
It's not for lack of trying. That's true. So this amendment, and I have a couple of amendments to the amendment, would say in the annual report and in the annual registration that there has to be a contact, real person who can be contacted for the partnership. And the amendments I would like is, the amendment as it's written now is the name and street and mailing address of an individual. I would like to include a phone number in that. So on line 1.30, after the word name, put in a comma, delete the first and, after the word address, put in and telephone number. And then on line 2.33, make the same language there. And then on 3.19, change calendar year 2007 to calendar year 2008. Evidently, these are all done on a calendar year, so they would start out the fresh calendar year 2008, having to give this one more piece of information. So, Madam Chair, I'd like to offer the A1 amendment as I just...
We'll incorporate those changes into your A1 amendment. Mr. Black, any reactions to the A1 amendment?
Madam Chair, it sounds good to me.
Madam Chair? Senator Scheid.
Madam Chair, do we say name and street and mailing address, because mailing address could be a post office box? I don't know if I have a street.
You don't have a street?
Well, I live. My house is on a street, but I mean, it just seems a very strange and awkward way to phrase it. The name and street of a person.
The name and street and mailing address. You have to put street and mailing with address.
I know. See, up here they do it the same.
Mr. Black, in your forms, how do you state something like this?
Madam Chair, I'm seeing that this is not for purposes of service of process. Usually for service of process, we try and get a street address. But as you can see in Clause 3, right, if you look at, for example, in line 2.30, that's the existing an example of where service of process would go. We have a space for mailing address, because more and more recently we have people who do not necessarily get mail delivered to their street address, and they list their mailing address, but we also need their street address for service of process. So I think we have a space for both of these possible.
For both?
Both street and mailing address. I can tell you that we have it on our 1985 Sperry Univac system. We have a space for both the street and the mailing address now.
So, Mr. Black, your conclusion is that the language as stipulated by Senator Higgins is all right, and that it's doable within your system?
I believe it is. I will say I have not had a chance to talk to our IT people about what if any cost there is, but we'll try and keep it down.
Senator Scheid, are you satisfied?
Well, Madam Chair, I still think it's strange, but it's apparently a stylistic thing for me. And it's not Senator Higgins doing it. It's not Mr. Black's doing it. It's whoever
was there before
wrote this in the first place. So that's fine.
Senator Olson?
Madam Chair and Senator Higgins and Mr. Black, if we're going to put the phone number in for purposes other than service of process, would there be a point in having it in and having it consistent in the section that refers to service of process?
Service of process is of course, generally either you go physically to the address or you mail it to the street address. I don't know that having a phone number for a service of process I think we've moved past that. Actually, an email address might be better than a phone number at this point in our development. But we're starting to collect those, too.
All right. Senator Torres-Reid, what are your thoughts on the A1 amendment?
It's okay with me.
Senator Torres-Reid is all right with the A1 amendment. Senator Higgins moved the A1 amendment. Is there any further discussions on the A1 amendment? Is there anybody in the audience who would like to speak on the A1 amendment? See none. Senator Higgins renews her motion on the A1 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion passes.
Thank you.
Is there anybody in the audience who would like to testify on Senate File 1346 as amended? Is there any further discussion on Senate File 1346 as amended? Senator Higgins moved that Senate File 1346 as amended be recommended to pass and be referred to. Do you want to see this?
Why?
It's got some fee changes in it, but I don't know how.
Madam Chair,
go to Senator Betzel's committee.
We were told that it needs to go to Senator Betzel, but it is our understanding that Senator Shy would like to see it in her committee, and we really don't know if she actually wants that or not. But our instruction was to move to Senator Betzel's committee.
Actually, we did have, although Senator Scheid is on the phone, hopefully she'll confirm this. I did talk to her just before the committee hearing, and she did indicate that, no, she did not need to see that in the Commerce Committee.
Okay, thank you.
Senator Higgins doesn't need to see it. Senator Betzel doesn't need to see it.
Well, no Senator Betzel does need to see it.
Yeah, he does need to see it.
It does have to go to finance.
Yes. He needs to see it.
I need to see it.
He might not want to,
Senator
but apparently...
Lamar?
You may have to.
All right.
I wanted to know what that sounded like.
Senator Higgins renews a motion that Senate File 1346 as amended be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Finance. Any further discussions? All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion passes. Congratulations.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you, members of the committee.
Senator Sparks.
So glad that we're noticed. I need to. No rising.
So thank you. Well, I got an hour, Sarah Sparks. Is it wisely?
Senator Sparks, Senate File 128.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members, for the opportunity to be in front of the committee today with Senate File 128. This is a bill that was heard in the Commerce Committee and re-referred to your committee, Madam Chair. This legislation clarifies how vehicle protection products sold with warranties will be treated in the marketplace. I know at some point you're very capable as prepared a technical amendment to kind of clean up some of the language.
I'll offer the A2.
The amendment is being passed out, so we'll wait till the amendment gets back.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair.
Well, let's... I'd like to look at it.
We'll just have a it's a technical amendment. I'll have Ms. Pontius explain it to the members, and then we can just.
Madam Chair, members, it does two things, and I think the summary that's going around also highlights what the judiciary issues are, I think. So there's just really a couple provisions in the bill the committee's looking at. One of them is data privacy. So the amendment does clean up that provision. If you look at... the first part of the amendment is just a cross-reference in the Data Practices Act to the data language that's in the bill, because this is any time that there's something that's outside of Chapter 13, just to try to make it more user-friendly, there's a cross-reference that's put into 13. So this just refers forward to that. And then the other is just a reworking of the actual data language itself, because I think the idea here is to
obviously makes a lot of the financial information that's being provided as part of the information given to the Commissioner of Commerce to find out whether these entities are financially responsible. There's a sentence on page 4, lines 33 and 34, that says it's trade secret and confidential and not subject to public disclosure. That's just not Data Practices Act language, so I just rewrote it so that it refers back to the trade secret data statute, and I think it accomplishes the same purpose. And then the last part of the amendment is the other area that I think seemed to be more under the committee's jurisdiction, and this is in sections 9 and 10, which deal with the record-keeping requirements. And in particular, the warrantors are supposed to make accounts and books and various records available to the Commissioner of Commerce for purposes of determining compliance with the law. And all this amendment really does, it deletes some language that's in paragraph D on page 7, lines 19 to 21, because the same language is kind of repeated down below in the Commissioner's powers. And so what the amendment does is just delete it in the one spot and then just add another reference in those powers to transactions regulated under this chapter in addition to records relating to the products sold by the warrantor. And so I think that basically gets to the same point and just condenses the language.
And members, those are the sections that drew our attention to this bill, and we wanted to get it here to help clean it up and really tighten it up a little bit. So the amendment actually basically is the portions of the bill that are in front of us. Any questions for Ms. Pontius or for Senator Sparks? I know, Senator Sparks, you have a witness here, but I think Mr. Cassidy, do you object to the amendment?
No, we're fine. Madam Chair, we're fine with the amendment. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you to you, Madam Chair, and to Senate Counsel for drafting that amendment.
Any questions on the amendment, members? Seeing none. Senator Olson moves the A2 amendment. All those in favor of the A2 amendment say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion passes. And then Senator Olson moves that Senate File 128 as amended be recommended to pass and be re-referred to. We're going to talk about where we're sending this. Does this go to the floor after here, Senator Sparks?
Madam Chair, are there registration fees in the bill? So I believe they have to go to the Finance Division for the Commerce Department.
All right. Senator Lummer?
Madam Chair, I don't know if we really reviewed the entire bill by itself as amended, but could we hear something? What's a vehicle protection product?
Mr. Cassidy.
Madam Chair, Senator Lummer, vehicle protection products are basically anti-theft devices, add-on products, aftermarket products that auto dealers will install in your car. Examples of those could be the club that you see on TV quite often. There are satellite tracking systems in which if your car is stolen, they can track your car. There are ignition disablers, so if your car is stolen, they can flip a switch and the ignition turns off. Products such as that. They range in price, and there's also glass etching and parts marking, in which glass etching is just what it says. They use an acid-based ink, and they etch your glass, all six pieces of your car, put a decal on your car to say that your car has marked glass, and basically thieves just walk right by those cars. I mean, the statistics from the insurance industry and others show that these products do a great deal to deter theft. Cars are becoming more expensive, and consumers are asking for these products more and more. The reason we're here, the reason we've asked for the model regulation that's passed in other states is that it also comes with a warranty. So we want companies that do distribute these products to register with the Commerce Department and prove financial viability by either filing an insurance reimbursement policy or having a net worth of $50 million or more.
Senator Lummer.
Madam Chair, I don't know of any other industry that we attempt to do this to, do we? For a product that's sold in Minnesota, could you tell me if there's any other products that we go to this much regulation over?
Yes.
Mr. Cassidy?
Madam Chair, Senator Lummer, in 2005 we actually passed legislation not dissimilar to this bill, in which we regulated service contracts, the types of contracts you would buy at Best Buy, to extend a product warranty on your stereo that you purchased or washing machine or whatever. It was the same situation. The marketplace was proliferating with these new products. Companies were making claims. Everybody was getting into the business, and no one really knew if there's anything standing behind those warranties. The legislature in 2005 passed that legislation. Now those companies are being regulated here by the Commerce Department.
Madam Chair, I noticed that some of the kind of a threshold of value that the company has to have in one respect, page 4, line 23, is a stockholder equity of $50 million. And am I reading this correctly that, or assuming that if you wanted to sell a product like this in the state of Minnesota, you have to have a company that large to promote a product here?
Mr. Cassidy?
Madam Chair, Senator Limbert, no. This legislation does not require you to do that. You can sell a theft deterrent or anti-theft product in the state of Minnesota, regardless. But if you have a warranty attached to that, you have to register with the Commerce Department and show financial viability that you can back up those warranties. But you can sell whatever anti-theft product you want here. But if you cross that threshold of offering a warranty with your product, then you have to register with the department.
Madam Chair, I'm not sure quite how warranties work as a business, but the warranty companies sometimes buy an insurance policy to indemnify themselves in the event that there is a loss. And would they then require a stockholder equity of $50 million in order to promote that product here? Had that type of insurance or something similar?
Mr. Cassidy.
Madam Chair, Senator Limbert, typically the manufacturer, the distributor, if they probably more often than not, at least the companies that I'm aware of, buy an insurance reimbursement policy. I mean, that's the easiest and cheapest way to go. And so right there you have an insurance policy that's in place. It's being regulated by the state of Minnesota through the Commerce Department.
Okay. Madam Chair, Senator, I just hope that we're not – we've spent maybe 10 minutes on this entire bill, and I'm hoping that this bill would not be considered a fencing bill to the point that some manufacturers or offers of this service are now establishing some type of threshold to do business in the state of Minnesota. And if you're not big enough or not rich enough, you could never compete in the state as a small, tiny company unless you meet certain rather large thresholds to get across. I hope that's not what I'm reading. Can you assure me that this bill is not that?
Senator Sparks or Mr. Cassidy?
Madam Chair, Senator Limbert, there's no intent of this to be a fencing bill. Companies have simply that are making these claims, these are warranties that range up to $5,000 and typically are $5,000. These products are being sold quite frequently. They're coming into Minnesota fairly quickly and fast. And auto dealers and consumers alike want to know that there's a company and an insurance policy or the net worth behind those companies to back up those claims. If the claims come in and those companies aren't backing them up, the auto dealer is going to get the phone call from the angry customer. The next call is going to go to legislators in the Attorney General's office.
Senator Higgins.
Madam Chair, Mr. Cassidy, who is your client? Who are you representing here today?
Mr. Cassidy.
Madam Chair, Senator Higgins, my client is the National Vehicle Protection Association. It's actually the manufacturers and the distributors of the anti-theft products.
Madam Chair.
Senator Scheid.
Madam Chair, I think that's not one manufacturer.
No.
That's an association.
That's a trade association.
A trade association of them. We did discuss this bill at length in the Commerce Department committee. I just elevated myself to the department.
Stick around, Senator Scheid. We might get you there.
I think I'm beyond the age. Can't even be a judge anymore.
You're younger than the commissioner now.
Anyway, Madam Chair, I think we felt it was important that when you see, you know, guarantees and warranties associated with this kind of a product, you want to know that there's something, there's substance behind it. And it's equally important for the dealers. I mean, clearly we care about the consumer, but the dealers want to know this before they start installing these products as well, because many of them are done by the dealer, right?
Correct.
Yeah. Any further questions for Senator Sparks or Mr. Cassidy. And members, I apologize. It's not my intention to curtail discussions on the substance of the bill, and I welcome curiosities for explanations for why the bills are before us. But out of fairness for other chairs and, you know, for the authors of the bills, I also want to be judicious about restricting our, you know, what we want to address within the jurisdiction of our committee. So, Senator Limmer, I do appreciate your questions on this subject area. Seeing none, Senator Olson renews her motion that Senate File 128 as amended be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Finance. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion passes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you.
And members,
look at us.
It is before 5 o'clock, and we are adjourned.